Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich. In this episode, I will be speaking with Philip C. Shackelford about his book Rise of the Mavericks, the U.S. Air Force Security Service and the Cold War, published by the U.S. Naval Institute Press in 2023. Philip Shackelford is currently serving as the library director at South Arkansas Community College in El Dorado, Arkansas. He is the past president of the Arkansas Library Association and is committed to supporting the Arkansas library community in a variety of other capacities. As a military historian, Philip Shackelford brings a unique focus on organizational culture and development to the history of communications, intelligence, national security, and the U.S. Air Force. Philip Shackelford, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we usually like to begin our interviews by asking our guests, tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in writing this book. What's the backstory behind it?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, like I said, thank you very much for having me on the show. Appreciate it very much, and I'm looking forward to the conversation today. But as you mentioned, my name is Philip Shackelford. I'm the library director at South Arkansas College. I'm a military historian focused on the U.S. Air Force and communications, intelligence, and national security during the Cold War. First became interested in kind of researching and writing about these topics during undergrad. So I've been with it for a while, but that interest was initially born of hearing my grandfather's stories growing up. My grandfather served in the U.S. Air Force Security Service during the early 1950s. And his stories, these kind of brief little anecdotes that he would share with my brother and I as we were growing up, just kind of served as my entry point to the topic, an introduction to the fact that this command even existed in the first place. And obviously, he never shared anything that would be, indicate how sensitive an organization the Security Service really was. Certainly not to, a couple of kids who did not yet have the context for everything that he was talking about. But like I said, the journey kind of continued for me in undergrad as you're going through the history program. Historical methods, you're looking forward to the senior seminar, you're starting to kind of cast about for topics that you can write about. And I decided, maybe I'll take a look at the Security Service and see what can be done with that as a topic, and was immediately surprised and kind of flabbergasted at just how little information was out there. Of course, come to find out there's a really good reason for that. It was an intelligence agency. Much still remains to be declassified. But I was hooked. I mentioned it to a professor I was working with at the time in a different department as a research assistant. And we started poking around, doing a little bit of research and things like that. And I never will forget, one day we're doing some of this and he looks up and very bluntly, he just says, "Your grandfather was a spy." And even if you started to get a hint, where the research might take you down the road, to have somebody put it to you like that, I mean, you don't forget it. And so, like I said, long story short, I was hooked and ended up staying with the topic and undergrad, stuck with it through grad school. And come to find out years later, the fact that my grandfather even ended up in the Air Force to begin with was almost an accident. He had, graduated high school in the spring of 1952, had little idea what he wanted to do, but he kind of saw the military as a way to fund his post-secondary education. And so without telling anyone, he traveled to the nearest military recruiting station, which is over 30 miles away, with the intention of signing up for the U.S. Marines. But the Marine Corps recruiter wasn't in the office that day. And so he kind of decided on the Air Force as a second choice, and of course, made a decision that would pave the next 4 years of his life and, of course, form lasting memories that remain vivid today. So absolutely fascinating journey there.
Now, what kind of sources were you able to consult for this? Because like you just mentioned, it's very secret. It was very secretive. There was not a lot of information available. Has kind of the archives become more available over the years now?
Well, yeah. So in large part, I mean, the sources that are available for a study like this are declassified military and other government documents, reports, memos, official histories, things like that. And given the nature of what has been declassified so far, the sources kind of support more of an organizational history as opposed to an operational history. Like I said, much remains classified, and the things that have been declassified tend to be scattered around the country in various different archives, various different places. And so it's a matter of kind of weaving together this tapestry of sources that are available. And using those sources, like I said, they kind of illustrate these larger bureaucratic decisions and kind of the rationales that supported those. In terms of other kinds of materials, I was able to conduct a few oral history interviews with surviving members of the Security Service, of course, including my grandfather. And these really serve to kind of personalize the narrative, right? To add that day in the life aspect of what it was like to serve in this command, which really, I think, helps to move the narrative along and kind of balance the bureaucratic kind of the 30,000 foot picture with some of what it actually meant to these folks on the ground. So kind of taking those two kinds of materials together in order to paint a more complete picture, hopefully, is kind of what was needed to do this. And I think as we see more and more things continue to be classified, hopefully that will allow us to write a more complete history, explore the story in a more complete way of the Air Force Security Service, but not only the Security Service, also the Army Security Agency, the Naval Security Group, who at this point in time have not had a dedicated history kind of exploring those organizations. So it's a fascinating and exciting time to be an intelligence historian.
Yes, it is, especially with some of the archives and all that being declassified. And of course, we're moving further and further away from when the Cold War ended, when that would have still been the case. Unfortunately for me, I usually specialize on Russian and Soviet espionage, so those sources are a little still hard to get for more reason than one.
Right.
Now, you mentioned my next question was, can you just briefly explain like what the Security Service was for our listeners who never have heard of this this agency or what the Air Force did during the early Cold War?
Yeah, so just to give folks kind of a broad overview, the U.S. Air Force Security Service was a communications intelligence, a communications security agency created by the Air Force in 1948, and its mission was to gather communications intelligence that would provide valuable information the Air Force needed to understand, to target, and to prevail over opposing forces during the Cold War, as well as to protect the security of internal Air Force communications. The mission did fluctuate as the Cold War progressed to include electronic warfare, electronic intelligence, and the command was actually renamed the Electronic Security Command in 1979 to kind of reflect those changes to the priorities. But the history, especially the early history, is not only fascinating, but it's also this incredible glimpse into the inner workings of American national security and intelligence gathering during the Cold War. The Air Force had been obliged to wait for a number of years as part of the U.S. Army before air leaders could really pursue service autonomy. And they knew that intelligence, especially in this new and uncertain Cold War environment, would be absolutely critical. And these two ideas were very clearly linked together. There's this great quote from General George McDonald, who in 1947, he'll become the first director of Air Force Intelligence. But back in 1945, the war's still going on. He's serving as director of intelligence for the U.S. Strategic Air Forces in Europe at the time. I mean, he writes this memo where he says, "It seems to me that when a service gives away dominion over its intelligence, it has, in fact, given up its independence. So as the United States emerged from World War II and started making this transition to the Cold War, these Air Force leaders knew what they were doing from the get-go. They immediately set about the task of establishing an effective communications intelligence organization that, again, would provide the information they needed, but at the same time, help the Air Force kind of overcome its dependence on the Army. And I think, you know, one of the reasons we've hardly ever heard about this command is, again, as we've been discussing, many of the records obviously are still classified, and that pertains to not only the operational and the activities, but also the relationships the security service had with other government agencies. But then another reason is that other intelligence organizations, such as the CIA, the NSA, attract a lot more attention and are more explored in the literature. But the security service is important, and it provides this useful lens, I think, to kind of look at the Air Force at large and the transformative developments that really characterize this transition from World War II into the Cold War.
Yeah, it's one interesting thing about the book and how you weaved everything together is also, this is almost as much, particularly the first few chapters, it's just as much about how the Air Force became its own independent branch as much as how did it develop its own intelligence service. And the quote that you just gave really sums it up. Now, you mentioned your grandfather, Thomas Shackelford. What did he do in the security service? How much did he tell you, or are you able to talk about?
Yeah,
about so get in trouble.
No, it's an interesting question because, I mean, he, like I said, he has shared a little bit. I think there's a lot more that he probably could share, but he hasn't at this point. But yeah, he was a crypto teletype operator, kind of responsible for taking the intercepted data collected by all of the intercept operators and then sending that information back to various headquarters in the States and elsewhere for processing and analysis. After separating from the service, he became an electrical engineer, ended up as director of a power company in our area. And I think, you know, it would be a really interesting area for further research to kind of look into the kinds of careers that security service personnel pursued after their time in the command, to explore whether or not their training, their experience as part of the security service had any impact on their civilian careers thereafter. I think that would be interesting to learn.
That is actually an interesting thing. That kind of reminds me, going back to my specialty, how even a lot of members of the Stasi, the German secret police, their intelligence agency, after, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall and then after, you know, the end of East Germany, a lot of them, you know, because they couldn't find employment in intelligence because of their background, but a lot of them, they became like private detectives and that sort of thing. So it's like, well, hey, I got the training, I got the equipment, so just
leverage the skills you have.
Yeah. And so it's kind of interesting that connection between, you know, intelligence and even like private investigator or even regular detective work. You even see it a little bit in the world of fiction too, but that's a whole another topic.
That's another podcast, right?
Yeah. Well, one of my previous interviews, I did actually discuss that, like how spy fiction in 19th century France, you know, kind of influenced the actual spy agencies of that time. Deborah Bauer. That was a really good interview. We talked about how your book is almost also about how the Air Force came about as an independent branch of the United States military. And the background to that is both World War I and World War II. So what was the impact of those two wars on the United States military that in some ways kind of created the need for the security service?
Yeah, so the way I would describe World War I is it's really a turning point for American intelligence kind of writ large. It's a moment in time when technological advances and attitudes towards intelligence activities are kind of coming together in a way that sets up how the United States will approach intelligence going forward. And there's a number of scholars who've written on this and continue to put out really good scholarship on this. And I'll just point to James Gilbert, Elizabeth Rojales-Smoot, and Mark Stout. I mean, I think your listeners should definitely pick up copies of their works to kind of learn more about how the First World War sets the stage for the growth and the development of American military intelligence. But so for its part, I mean, World War II then has been called a, quote, SIGINT war, SIGINT for signals intelligence, which is a term that's coined by the now famous cryptologist William Friedman. And it's an apt description because when it came to signals intelligence, communications intelligence, the Allies transformed the world of espionage and kind of laid the technological and the philosophical foundation for cryptologic work that remains in large part to this day. Much of the Allied success in this area was built on progress made by British codebreakers initially, who succeeded in cracking German Enigma traffic. That program, and of course, the information it provided were known by the codename Ultra. And Ultra Intelligence provided much needed insight for the Allies in situations that obviously helped achieve important victories. Where the United States, I think, in particular, had some challenges was in the organization and the coordination of its intelligence activities, especially in the early years leading up to World War II and then the early years of the war. Army and Navy intelligence units did not cooperate well with each other and, in fact, behaved towards rivals towards each other, which made, obviously, for problematic combination of overlap, duplication, squabbles over jurisdiction, all of these things. Following World War II, then, American military and government officials knew that this level of dysfunction, for lack of a better word, could not be allowed to continue. And so they spent a lot of time after the war, kind of in the late 1940s, working and arguing over how the United States intelligence apparatus should be organized. And that, of course, included communications intelligence.
Now, that rivalry you just mentioned between the Army and the Navy, is that kind of why the Air Force needed its own independent intelligence and independent of the Army and the Navy?
Yeah. So that's, going back to the quote from General George McDonald, have to remember that the Army Air Forces, the Army Air Corps before that, well back into the interwar period, had been extremely interested in pursuing service autonomy. And really only World War II itself kind of delays this push for greater independence. Add to that the fact that Air Force leaders were never really satisfied by the intelligence support they received from Army's military intelligence. Air intelligence was often controlled by, military intelligence organizations and personnel that had very little understanding of the kind of unique needs and perspectives and priorities that Air Force leaders had. And so these ideas, again, are really clearly linked to Air Force independence and the need for air intelligence. And like I said, these Air Force leaders kind of emerged from this experience in World War II with a very clear idea of what they feel needs to happen. And they start laying the groundwork for setting up an independent kind of autonomous communications intelligence organization. This is a time when the Air Force is on its way up, right? Building on what air leaders kind of see as the decisive demonstration of capability and value during World War II, making their case, continuing to make their case for service independence. And it would be in that environment, you can see how it'd be fairly difficult and counterintuitive, really, for the Air Force to continue relying on another service for intelligence, especially, again, as we've mentioned, the Air Force and air leaders have never really been fully satisfied with the support they received from military intelligence. And so the security service then becomes a key piece of overcoming that dependence. And it's also this incredible little microcosm of the kind of fierce independence that characterizes the Air Force at large more broadly. We are the Air Force for something different than the Army. We have a different capability and mission and something different that we offer to national defense. And so air leaders are very intent on protecting the autonomy of this intelligence capability, making sure that it can serve Air Force needs and Air Force priorities first, if not exclusively. Hap Arnold, an example, was one of the key figures kind of grossly dissatisfied with intelligence support that the Air Force received from the Army during World War II. And he knew that going forward, something had to change. And just as an example, I mean, Arnold himself was never officially informed about Ultra, but he found out on his own through his own kind of personal network. So that's just an example of kind of the dysfunction that existed between all of the different commands and services during the war when it came to intelligence. General Hoyt Vandenberg is another person I would point to. Kind of he becomes vice chief and eventually chief of staff of the Air Force. and had also been in close contact with communications intelligence during the war. Really impressed with how the British system worked, and was very interested in and seeing what could be done to set up the Air Force going forward after the war. In 1949, he would play a key role in kind of preserving security service autonomy. And that step was necessary because of these ongoing and often very contentious debates concerning the proposed consolidation of military communications intelligence agencies into a single joint organization. The Air Force and the Navy had opposed each other in the military unification debates after the war. The Navy, by and large, saw very little need for an independent Air Force. But they found themselves in the kind of the unfamiliar position as allies in the struggle against communications intelligence consolidation, but for different reasons. The Navy opposed this centralization because kind of consolidating command and control into a single joint agency would interrupt the decentralized system of command that the Navy really viewed as critical to its mode of operation. While the Air Force, for its part, as we've seen, kind of viewed this as a matter of survival as an independent service. And so given the importance of communications intelligence to strategic bombing, which was part and parcel of the Air Force's kind of service identity at this point, remaining dependent on other agencies for intelligence, and or kind of subordinating Air Force intelligence capabilities to joint control and direction was just an untenable proposal. So ultimately, in a surprise reversal, or at least a surprise to the Navy, the Air Force eventually agreed to support general consolidation of communications intelligence, but only after a compromise proposal was submitted by the Army, which allowed individual service agencies to retain at least some autonomous control. And so then the Air Force promptly designates all of its intelligence assets as mobile units, kind of taking advantage of a loophole in the proposal and largely escaping the sacrifices to joint assignment that followed when the Armed Forces Security Agency was ultimately created. And so this single-minded focus, right, this preparation and the bureaucratic navigation that kind of made these amenable results possible is the overarching characteristic of kind of the security services rise to prominence in the post-war cryptologic community. What the Army and various elements of the executive branch saw as territorialism and defiance, the Air Force kind of understood as pursuing institutional priorities and safeguarding independence, kind of shrewdly maneuvering like the Mavericks they were seen to be.
Yeah. Now, you talked about how the Air Force was dependent on the Army during World War II, but it was able to do some intelligence on its own a little bit. And you do talk about this in the book. What type of intelligence were the Air Force in quotation marks, because it wasn't a separate branch at this time, was able to do during World War II that kind of sets up the stage for what comes afterwards and what becomes the security service?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think so. There's a number of different things that the Army Air Forces get into with regards to intelligence and a number of different strategies that they pursue. Going into the war, I mean, in the 1930s, I think particularly, the air attaché system was important and was kind of one of the key pieces of intelligence that air leaders really relied on. But not necessarily, it didn't provide the kind of information that would have been decisive in military operations, especially in something as serious as World War II. And there's a lot of challenges that go along with the attaché system and the kinds of information that they're able to provide. What ultimately ends up happening is that although the AAF continues to kind of push military intelligence for the kinds of information it needs, continues to kind of have those interagency debates and arguments, Hap Arnold ends up relying a lot on civilian consultants when it comes to intelligence and kind of the especially when it comes to targeting and putting together targeting packages that can look at specific bases, specific cities and industries and those kinds of things in Nazi Germany and Japan and kind of putting that information together. So this really sets up the relationship between the Army Air Forces and intelligence itself that we will kind of continue to see as World War II kind of comes to a close, and as the Air Force and the United States military and government kind of at large are making this transition from World War II into the Cold War. This really, really close relationship between the Air Force and the needs it has for intelligence, but also science and technology, and the close relationship between all of those things is a key piece of understanding how all this worked together.
Now, moving into the early Cold War, this kind of changes a little bit of the dynamics within the United States military. And in some ways, this creates a little bit of the momentum for an independent U.S. Air Force, and also the need for its own independent intelligence service. You did kind of cover that previously, but how did the early Cold War kind of affect the Air Force, and you know, what role did intelligence play in that?
Yeah, so at the outset of the Cold War, I think building on or at least using the experience of World War II as an example, Air Force leaders really see themselves as the first line of defense when it comes to the Cold War, the Soviet Union, and kind of the strategic questions that need to be addressed. And so a lot of the philosophy, a lot of the steps and kind of the decisions that are being made have to do with the strategic threat and setting up effective capability that will be able to respond and protect not only the American homeland, but American interests in the Cold War environment. And so that's the philosophy, that's the attitude that the Air Force really enters the Cold War with. And I think where that kind of meets the road when it comes to the security service is that the security service itself was also geared toward understanding the strategic threat and providing the kinds of information that would be necessary for the Strategic Air Command and the Air Force to prevail over the Soviet Union and over what was largely seen probable to be a nuclear exchange if it got to that point. And I think so the Air Force at large and the security service specifically are entering the Cold War with that mindset. And of course, we'll see that start to change a little bit when it comes to the Korean War.
Yeah, we'll get to that soon enough. Now, two main responsibilities of the security service was signals intelligence and communications intelligence. But you explained that those two are not the same thing, although people get them confused. Can you kind of explain the distinction between the two and how the security service performed those operations?
Yeah, it's a good point. I think the signals intelligence, communications intelligence are used interchangeably in a lot of different settings. But the way I like to describe it is that communications intelligence is a form of signals intelligence, in that the actual content of messages being sent by radio signals and other means is intercepted, processed, analyzed, and then used to try and understand what a given adversary is up to. Signals intelligence more broadly indicates intelligence that is gathered from the use of signals themselves, which can include things like what kind of information is equipment is being used, what locations the signals are being sent from, patterns of transmission, things like that. So communications intelligence itself is almost a subset or a subtype of signals intelligence more broadly.
Now, a major figure who is mentioned in your book is Richard P. Klocko. Is that how you pronounce his name? Yeah. And who was this? Who was Klocko, and what was his significance to the Air Force and the security service?
Yeah, General Klocko is a fascinating figure, and he does feature very heavily in the early history of the security service particularly. He's a graduate of West Point, class of 1937, and after flight training eventually becomes the commander of pursuit squadrons. We'd call them fighter squadrons today, first in Puerto Rico and then in England, and then is deployed to North Africa, where he's actually shot down and taken prisoner. He spends almost 2.5 years as a prisoner of war, actually held in Stalag Luv 3, which is the prison camp made famous by the movie The Great Escape. And is ultimately released, transferred back to the United States in the spring of 1945. But before very much of his allotted recuperation period has elapsed, he receives these surprise orders to the Pentagon. He's not too happy about that. And he's initially given a staff job And then a role within the G2, the Military Intelligence Division. And finally kind of becomes involved in communications intelligence and learning about the various facets of that work, all with the underlying intention that he will essentially put the Air Force in the business of communications intelligence. And keep in mind that at this point, the Air Force itself doesn't exist yet. It's still part of the U.S. Army. So these preparations are being made against the day that the Air Force does, in fact, become an independent service. And Klocko is ultimately the person responsible for doing the legwork, you know, laying the foundation for organizing and creating the group that will eventually become the Air Force Security Service. So, yeah, just absolutely fascinating character and a great story.
Yeah, so now we get into some of the big events of the Cold War and what role the Security Service played during them. And probably one of the first ones was the Korean War, because there was a lot of air combat, especially in Big Alley up in the border of North Korea and China, where at first the Soviet pilots were there fighting the Americans, and then later they trained Chinese and North Koreans to fight. But what role did the Security Service play in the Korean War, especially with some of that air combat that I just meant briefly summarized?
Yeah, so as we briefly mentioned already, Korea is really the first sort of real world test of the Security Service and of the Air Force at large following World War II. As we've mentioned already, the Air Force and the Security Service both at this point had a very strong emphasis towards the strategic threat. They were not necessarily thinking about fighting another conventional war in Korea. And so there's a period of chaotic just everything goes haywire in those early years, those early months of the Korean conflict, as the Security Service struggles to get assets in place. They have to train up Korean linguists because they're just really at this point not prepared for a conflict in Korea. Where I think the success stories really come from is kind of what you mentioned, that the tactical picture. The Security Service really gets involved in supporting the tactical air operations and sets up a really innovative way of doing that, where they're able to kind of move into difficult areas with vans and portable equipment, set up a line to tactical air control, and where they're able to take the information that they get from intercepts and relay that to tactical air control, and which then in turn is relayed to the fighter pilots on the line. And the pilots themselves, they may not necessarily know, and certainly probably didn't know where the information was coming from. But in a sense, their radar got a whole lot better, and they were able to improve the kill ratio over the MiGs and kind of turn the tide there. So that's where the Security Service really played an important role. After that initial period of adjustment and having to put together an effective operation, the tactical picture is really where they a good success. Story.
And then the other major, or the next major area that the Security Service played in, was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which had both tactical and especially strategic implications. So what was the role that they played in the Cuban Missile Crisis? Because I'm sure they played a huge role.
Yeah, they did, and I think that's where more and more documents will hopefully be declassified and give us a little bit better picture about what all went down during the Cuban Missile Crisis. But yeah, the way I talk about it is the 50s were really a period of expansion for the Security Service, and then the 60s were a period of maturation. And by the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis and by the time of Vietnam, the Security Service had gotten a lot better at what it called crisis response. So putting together units that were essentially, they called them emergency reaction units. These units that were designed to be portable, to be mobile, to get into difficult areas, difficult terrain, and set up an effective intercept operation. One of these units was deployed to Florida during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and really was instrumental in setting up an effective operation that kept leaders, policymakers informed on the movements of opposing forces and really what was going on in Cuba and around Cuba, and kind of helping to navigate that challenge. Another one of these units was deployed to Southeast Asia, And I think we can talk about that a little bit more with the early years of American involvement in Southeast Asia, which, again, I think starts a lot earlier than some people might think, but initially is established to get more information on the Chinese Air Force, because the security service operations, flights around the periphery of China, kind of based in Japan and the Philippines, are not picking up everything that they feel they need to. And so they're starting to look towards Western China and locations in that area that can set up a more effective intercept operation.
Yeah, you just mentioned our involvement with Vietnam got earlier than most people realize. Actually, in some ways, it kind of bleeds into the end of World War II, where we had OSS agents cooperating with Ho Chi Minh. So that's kind of the origins. And then there's also the French Indochina War, where we're trying to give support to the French. And then afterwards, then we start sending advisors, and it's not until the mid-60s that we start getting more directly involved. But it's, you know, it happens in different ways, and it kind of originates from World War II. So it is kind of interesting, and also a little interesting how intelligence plays a role in that. But yeah, during the actual Vietnam War, the mid-60s, when we get more directly involved, what role did the security services play in that conflict?
Yeah, so as indications that something might happen in Southeast Asia and in Vietnam, the security service really was geared towards supporting and being prepared for the moment when an air war might break out, which of course it did. And so then in Vietnam, we kind of again see the tactical success like we saw in Korea, where the security service is able to provide really, really key support to fighters who are engaging opposing forces over Vietnam and in the area. Again, related to kind of expanding over and above what radar is able to provide and really showing where the opposing fighters are coming from, where they're going to be, patterns, locations, things like that. Operation Bolo, which of course is a very famous engagement your listeners will be familiar with. The security service plays a key role in not only the operational aspect, but also the deception that was involved with that campaign. Kind of masking the identity of the fighters and the aircraft that were involved, so that they would not appear as fighters to opposing forces, and then transmitting, kind of providing MIG alerts to fighters on the line to provide again over and above what their radar could provide, and not only where they were in kind of the operational sense, but the bases they came from, the times that they launched, and all that kind of information to provide a better picture to the American fighters who were engaging those opposing forces. So it's again a matter of tactical support. And I think we also see, when it comes to Vietnam and kind of how the security service operated, a real balancing act between what was seen as kind of the operational priorities, what the Air Force needed tactically on the ground, but then also the national level priorities that were at this point in time being directed by the NSA, and those kinds of questions. So the security service really is engaged in kind of balancing those priorities to hopefully provide a complete picture to everyone involved.
Now, were they involved at all with the bombing campaigns of North Vietnam, like providing intelligence to the Air Force, like where to go and what are the missile defense?
Yeah, so that's where I think we see maybe a little bit of a limitation of the sources. The sources that I've seen really don't get into the bombing campaigns. If I had to make an educated guess, I would say that they're engaged in much the same kind of thing, providing information about where the targets are, where the enemy forces are, and where they may be coming from, and things like that. But that's, I think, a limitation, of, at least of the sources that may be declassified, or at least what I've seen, doesn't really get into the bombing campaigns.
To put it another way, yes, they did, but it's classified.
Right.
Wow, this has been a very fascinating discussion. What is the legacy of this era of Air Force intelligence? And obviously, the Air Force today still has its own intelligence services. But of course, you focused on the early Cold War period because of, as you said, part of the sources are more available. But what is kind of the legacy that we know or what we can speak of?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think The simple, the straightforward answer to that question is obviously the organizational descendant, kind of the lineage of the security service extends to Air Force's cyber, which is in operation today. You can kind of trace the organization through the 80s, the 90s, as the command, the units were changed names or reorganized in various different ways. So organizationally, there's a clear line from the security service to what's being done today. I think the lessons, if there are, you know, when we talk about lessons and legacy and kind of what the relevance of this history is for modern leaders, modern policymakers, I think has to do with the communication and the coordination between intelligence agencies and how crucial that really is. And the lessons of what can happen when rivalry and lack of communication, lack of coordination is allowed to kind of take over. And I think that's an important lesson of the book. Again, having more of an organizational approach as opposed to an operational approach and telling that larger story. You know, I'm a self-diagnosed big picture person. And so kind of looking at that from the 30,000 foot level and kind of being able to extract some of those lessons and what it might mean for our folks doing these kinds of operations today, I think is an important thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, that's actually one of the interesting things about intelligence history is that it does connect very much so with the big picture, and you can just connect so many different things. Even in your book, I mean, you talk a lot about like how the Air Force was created, but you also talk about like the geopolitics of the early Cold War and like what is the Air Force trying to respond to, why it needs its independence. So it's all interconnected. Do you have any further thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I think it's, you know, you pull one thread and you're going to get the whole ball of yarn, right? So I think that this book is hopefully a good way for folks who may be interested in one aspect or another to kind of get a sense of how all of these things worked well together and really how the security service is a really interesting piece of this larger, you know, complex puzzle that really kind of characterizes the transition from World War II into the Cold War, and then kind of the philosophy and the decision and the rationales that supported decision-making of the, you know, American government military, but also the U.S. Air Force throughout the early years of the Cold War. So it's if any of that is interesting to anyone out there, then I encourage you to pick up a copy and hopefully it's valuable.
This will be admittedly a lighthearted question, but from the title, I couldn't help but think, oh, is he trying to play on the recent success of Top Gun Maverick? And I even had to explain to friends and family, like, oh, what's your next interview? I was like, well, it's this true story behind that, but it's the Air Force, not the Navy. So
right.
my lighthearted question is, do you get asked that at all, or do you people make that connection at all to you?
They do. I have been asked that question. In reality, it's not a reference to Top Gun. The title goes back to my undergrad days, and I thought it was a good title. I wanted to save it for the book, and it really kind of gets to the attitude of the security service personnel of the Air Force at large, kind of in the late 40s and early 1950s, but also the perception that the Army and other executive branch organizations kind of viewed the security service and the Air Force kind of as these mavericks. They were kind of out to protect their own independence and protect their own priorities. And I think we see that on both sides, right? We see it from the folks who are kind of looking at the Air Force from the outside, but we also see it on the behavior of Air Force personnel themselves and what they're trying to do. So I think that I'll definitely capitalize on the Google search, you know, the search engine optimization of the popularity of that, but it's not a Top Gun reference.
Yeah, my one friend said, yeah, you know, probably the Air Force has its own little top pilot program, and it's probably even better, but you know, the Navy gets the credit because of the movie. Do you have any final thoughts? Maybe touch on anything in the book that we weren't able to get to in the discussion.
Well, like I said, I think this is it's the very beginning. This field is really wide open for research. I mean, as I pointed out, I mean, just has the security service had not been written about and has not until this point had a history kind of dedicated to it. The Army Security Agency, the Naval Security Group as well, are in the same position. And so I think as we hopefully continue to see more and more declassification and more and more records become available, then we can begin to tell the story of these organizations that in large part are missing from the pages of history and are kind of overshadowed by organizations and intelligence agencies that kind of have a more popular profile, right? The NSA, the CIA, but the kind of telling the story of those larger organizations is not the whole story. And so I think it's incredibly valuable to take a step back and look at these other organizations that play key roles in how the United States and the government, the military really transitioned from World War II into the Cold War and kind of the steps that they took to navigate that conflict.
Well, we always like to end our interviews by asking our guests, what are you working on now?
So, yeah, I think, you know, it's a occupational hazard, right, for historians. There's always too many ideas, too many projects. But one of the next things I'm hoping to work on is going to zoom out again a little bit and take a look at communications intelligence and kind of its relationship with modern warfare. What the impact there might be. So I'm just kind of nibbling around the edges of that project at the moment and laying some of the foundational work. But yeah, there's a lot of irons in the fire. I think it's as a first book, I found the process incredibly addicting. And so I'm looking forward to continue to put out more projects.
Well, when you finish some of that research and get it published, maybe we can have you back on the podcast.
Absolutely. Love to.
Philip C. Shackelford, thank you for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich. Until next time.